Calling the Environment Policy Oversight Committee to order. We do have to approve the minutes from February 25. And Representative Anderson.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson moves the minutes February 25, 2010. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We are going to begin with a bill from Representative Hornstein, House File 3061. And while Representative Hornstein is coming down, I will move that House File 3061 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Welcome, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's great to be back before your committee. Members, this House file is a very simple addition or change to the one piece of the solid waste management hierarchy. As you know, members and Mr. Chair, the state has a general overarching policy around preferences for solid waste management, and this small change to the hierarchy just represents an acknowledgement of a new and emerging, I think, very positive development in waste management in our state, which is to actually collect and separate out additional items for composting beyond food waste and yard waste, which are currently composted. And before I bring up my a couple of testifiers, I want to just let you know my motivation for bringing this bill forward comes from a project that has been taking place for almost a year in my district in southwest Minneapolis. And it's initiated by a grassroots organization of neighbors that want to do something positive for the environment. And they came up with an idea that's also being supported. This is a nonprofit group, but they're getting help from Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis to provide bins for residents who volunteer, and you'll hear more about this, where they can separate out their food waste, napkins, soiled pizza boxes, other wrapper-type materials that are paper and non-recyclable, and bring those in a compostable bag out to the curbside in a separate bin, which looks very similar to, you know, the regular garbage bin. And then that those materials, which, you know, constitute up to about a quarter of the waste stream, can then be taken, and this is in addition to the food waste, can then be taken to a facility that's in Representative Stirner's district to be composted and then sold and used for all kinds of different materials or different purposes, among them landscaping for MnDOT, for example. So this is a wonderful project that is being embraced enthusiastically, not only in my own neighborhood where it started, but now four other neighborhoods in the city of Minneapolis. There's other communities in the suburbs that are doing this. And so this is to say, we think that source-separated composting is an important part of our waste management mix. We want the state to be supporting this, and the hierarchy is a very appropriate place to acknowledge, I think, a very positive development for the future of waste management in our state. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I again, it's just one line, and we're saying this is a little bit more than just food waste, and so we use the term source-separated compostable materials. And I have a couple of testifiers that can amplify more of this, the need for this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And I see first on the list is Felicity Britton.
Well, I should.
Or did you want?
We'll have Susan Hubbard first from Eureka Recycling, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
That would be fine.
And I think we've already loaded up a PowerPoint presentation for you, a very short one.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Hubbard, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm Susan Hubbard from Eureka Recycling.
And I'm Tim Brownell, also of Eureka Recycling.
Welcome.
Eureka Recycling is a nonprofit 501c3, and we're headed into our 10th year, and our mission is to demonstrate that waste is completely preventable. And we're just going to talk really briefly today about this very simple, really easy fix so that we can get more people composting in Minnesota. And right now, our phone's ringing off the hooks. We have 60,000 phone calls a year from people throughout Minnesota, interest and questions around how to compost and when they can start composting like Linden Hills. And this is an easy fix that's going to get us there.
Yeah. And so the first thing that we just want to touch on is kind of where are we at within the state of Minnesota currently relative to composting and recycling and wasting. We are at a recycling rate in the state of about 44%. Composting is sitting less than 3%. 3% of what we're collecting or able to manage in the state is being composted. We're still wasting or throwing away over 53% of the materials in the waste stream.
And so we wonder why, if composting is such a great strategy, why isn't there more composting going on in Minnesota? And so we're trying to address that problem today. There are some barriers, and the current language right now is a barrier. It's not that there isn't the compost there, and it's not that people won't do it. Felicity, the Linden Hills Power and Light folks will talk about the enthusiasm for this project. Right now, in the waste stream in Minnesota, over 25% of what's currently being thrown away could easily be composted. But unfortunately, it's being managed in much lower parts of the hierarchy.
So what this legislation does is it adds additional materials to the definition of source-separated organics. It adds, beyond food waste, it adds paper towels, napkins, pizza boxes, as were stated before, other easily and readily available compostable materials. It also is a very simple wording change and legislative change and has no financial impact on the state.
So what the reason that we're coming here today is, and asking for this is because we need to change the policy, the hierarchy as it reads right now. And although there is discussion around rulemaking around composting, policy in the state of Minnesota has always led rulemaking. And what this does is it clears the policy and it says, yes, instead of landfilling napkins and paper towels and items that could easily be composted, we're going to move them up the stream. So this bill, basically the change to this bill is what that does, what it accomplishes.
And what happens when we do compost is that this material has many environmental benefits to it, but specifically it does things such as improves the health and workability of soils, can be used throughout the agricultural system within our state. It reduces soil erosion, prevents stormwater runoff, minimizes the use of pesticides and fertilizers when used in agricultural purposes.
So really, in conclusion, it's as simple as changing some wording right now where it says food waste to change it to read source-separated compostable so that along with the food waste, we can compost our napkins and our paper towels, things that are really simple. People are already doing it right now. But they're doing it under pilot project or variances, and there's no structure or there's no sound process that says that this is the policy in the state of Minnesota that we would prefer to compost these items into healthy soils than to have them landfilled or incinerated. It's a quick fix, and by doing this and by increasing the amount of composting, we're increasing green jobs in Minnesota. For every one job that's created in landfilling or incineration, there are four jobs that are created through composting. So it's a simple and quick fix, but the ripple effect and the benefit to the citizens who want to compost, to the soils in Minnesota, and job development, it's really kind of just opening the door to a lot of great potential. So we thank you for this time today to hear this testimony, and we would welcome any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. And are there any questions for either Mr. Brown or Ms. Hubbard? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. My name is Felicity Britton, and I'm the executive director for Linden Hills Power and Life.
My name is Tom Braun, and Linden Hills Power and Life began in our living room in Linden Hills about 4 years ago. And let me just tell you one thing, and then I'll turn it over to our executive director. We considered, when we started the program, we sent out an invitation to folks in the neighborhood to sign up as compost captains. This was to help direct a source-separated organic pilot project the city of Minneapolis started almost 2 years ago. We considered inviting all of them to come here and testify today. I ran that idea past Frank, and he decided it was better if just two of us came. So,
I just wanted to testify about the enthusiasm out there behind composting. We have 50% of our neighborhood is signed up. As Frank said, it's just been going a year. We're pushing to get about 70% of our neighborhood signed up. But right now we have 1,200 people composting in our neighborhood. We would like to see that be permanent, and we'd like to see that spread throughout the city. I get phone calls all the time from other neighborhoods, other cities, saying, how can we have a pilot like this in our area? And we would like to see the rules change so that can be a reality for them. There are schools in Hopkins, Orono, Edina, Minnetonka, Wayzata. There are 21 Minneapolis schools composting. And you can just see the difference in the compost green carts versus the trash. The residents are diverting 4 tons per week from Linden Hills, and these schools, it's all the milk containers, milk cartons, waxed paper, paper bags, and food scraps. It's like 80 to 90% of their waste at the schools is compostable. We just want to see this small change in language to remove the barriers so we can spread this throughout the city and the state. Thank you.
And I was just going to ask, and I know it was, because it was Ms. Hubbard that was saying that you need to get either variances or have them established as pilot projects before it can move forward. So this would this bill is designed to remove that obstacle so they don't have to get the variances and or be listed as pilot projects.
Yes, Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, we have next Charlie Camaro. Hi. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You could state your name, please, for the tape.
My name is Charlie Camaro, and I am the Business and Government Relations Associate for Visium. And I literally have half a page of talking points, I guess, for lack of better words, so I will not take up much of your time at all. Visium's innovative technology processes and extracts organics within mixed municipal solid waste and diverts all plastics and metals to their respective recycling markets. We are an innovative technology in the field of waste management. The result of Visium's technology is a standardized organic material that can serve as an excellent feedstock into anaerobic digestion. I am before you now for two reasons. I support the notion that Minnesota's waste hierarchy deserves and needs amending. The currently proposed amendment, 3061, encourages the source separation of organics, and while this amendment parallels Minnesota's leadership in environmental care, I encourage the committee and the authors of the bill to not stop there. This brings me to my second and final point. Visium's emerging technology does not fit into any of the current categories under the hierarchy. I believe the space where we almost fit is under line number 2.1 and 2.2, which is about MSW composting and incineration. Emerging technologies such as Visium's that have the ability to effectively recover and utilize the resources within mixed municipal solid waste, and doing so, and this is important, and doing so without utilizing the thermal or BTU value of those resources, i.e. incineration, should fall into different categories within the hierarchy. I call for the committee and the authors of this bill to consider distinguishing between incineration and effective resource recovery of municipal solid waste. It is my opinion that changes to the amendment don't further exclude emerging technologies. I do have a document submitted that is about anaerobic digestion, and I thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you for the materials. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kamara, maybe you could just describe the what the technologies. I've seen it. It's just in a pilot scale, but it's a big thermal vessel. It's like a big cylinder, and you heat up the materials, and you can put a variety of feedstocks in it.
Absolutely.
You could use sur-separated organics. You could use garbage. And then you heat it up, and then you can eventually cull out the recyclables if you wanted to, but you can also get these little pellets, which you can then heat up and put in a digester, right?
That's exactly correct. I did not mean to be elusive in what our technology is. I just didn't want to come up here and pitch who we are. But exactly right, Mr. Gardner. Our technology is a vessel. It's similar to an autoclave, if you're familiar, but it does not have a boiler. Essentially, the vessel operates as a pressure cooker that you might have in your kitchen. I don't have one, but you might. We have a pressure cooker that cooks trash. It's very simple. It breaks down all the organics inside to a homogeneous, standardized size and structure. And then you're able to separate out those organics with inorganics. In those inorganics, you have recyclable material that you can separate out further and get revenue from and keep from going into a landfill. In the organics, you can further homogenize that material and put it through different, you can use it as different feedstocks for different technologies, including anaerobic digestion.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Just as a follow-up, but there's nothing in Representative Hornstein's bill that would preclude you from doing what you're doing. You're suggesting that if we added something at some other time, that would facilitate the kind of alternative technology you're talking about.
Ms. Camaro.
Yes, thank you. It's very similar to the reason why Eureka came up here and wanted source-separated organics. It has been a barrier to make things happen. And right now, with an emerging technology, a new technology such as ours, even though it does good things, we still don't fit anywhere. We kind of fit into the gray space. And so if there are going to be further amendments, or maybe with this one, it could be considered.
Thanks, Ms. Camaro. Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if my question's for the author, or maybe possibly for Representative Gardner or Representative Saylor. I'm just curious, this legislation, I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I mean, it sounds okay. It's not going to potentially lead to something that would get recycled or reused. It's definitely lower in the hierarchy. We're not going to have any less recycling by changing this. What's actually going to happen by the change in this legislation? Maybe Representative Hornstein, I could start there. What actually will be the effect? And then just another question would be, there's no way that there's going to be less recycling something.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I think that's an excellent question. No, I think that the net effect would not affect the technologies and strategies outlined at the top of the hierarchy ahead of this. But we do anticipate it would divert waste that's potentially now going to landfills and incinerators, and that it would be preferable to compost that. We believe it's safer to do that. It's a higher and better use. It'll conserve landfill space, especially, and really open the door to, I think, looking at a good 20% of the waste stream now that may potentially fit into this category. So that would be the net effect. It wouldn't affect recycling newspapers, cardboard, newsprint, things of that nature. But we're going to capture, for example, these paper products, towels, napkins, soiled pizza boxes, milk cartons, and food. There's quite a bit of food that's now thrown into landfills and in incinerators that now will be safely composted.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, how about the little clear white plastic thing that sits in the middle of the pizza that stops the top of the box from smushing the pepperonis? Some of us have worked hard to keep plastic out of compost in different ways. That's a whole different issue. But I'm wondering, how will you be dealing with issues like that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative McNamara. We'll have Ms. Hubbard answer that question. But I think the majority of pizza boxes don't have plastic, but some do. So it's a valid question.
Ms. Hubbard.
Yeah, they do. And we've been involved in a lot of projects to educate residents to sort out for composting, and a lot of these pilots that we've been talking about. And effectively what we do is that we explain to people about what materials are compostable and what materials aren't. And they're so dedicated to doing this. And Felicity has a great story about how people began to understand that some of the dental floss that they were using really wasn't cotton-based, and it was more of a plastic-based dental floss, and then people went to a great extreme to make sure that they were keeping that out of their composting. And there are people, it sounds like maybe people are overly enthusiastic, but really people are very dedicated to the idea that what is compostable and could go back into soil and help improve our soils and our agriculture in Minnesota. They're very dedicated to this idea, and so it's via this education. I think another quick answer to that, too, is that there's a lot of companies right here in Minnesota that are starting to create soy plastics, which I think are going to end up in those kinds of products like that, where they're often going to get composted. A lot of the restaurants now are offering products for to-go, to take home food, and a lot of that, if you read it, will say that it's compostable. That it's completely biodegradable, and it's made out of soybeans. It's soy-based. So there's all kinds of emerging technologies that people are understanding that more and more materials could get composted.
And I was just wondering, as far as the materials, how much of it is non-compostable? You said that they do a good job beforehand of making sure that they're compostable materials and not recyclable. But for those that do get through, I was wondering how much does, and what happens? Is there any way that that can be pulled out of the compostable material, or does that just get thrown in with it? Ms. Hubbard.
Chair. Yes, it's a really good question. In the programs that we're talking about and that I'm familiar with, the amount of contamination, that's what we call it, that's the material that you don't want in there, is so minimal. We often, and when we're actually measuring it, we actually, you know, since we do this as a living, and I know it sounds shocking, but we actually do waste sorts of the compostable material to see what we're actually composting. And what we know is that less than 1% of what we're collecting in the programs that we're operating is not compostable. Now, what happens to that material is a really good question. Mm-hmm. And there's, to be perfectly honest with you, there's only so much screening that you can do in composting. There's only so much screening that is allowed in terms of the technology of making sure that material is removed. So how much of that we can remove is really important at the source, and that's through education programs, because the technology on the back end, to rely on some technology to try to remove like a little tiny micrometer of plastic is going to be really tricky and probably very expensive. That being said, there's no environmental study that exists that says that landfilling it or incinerating it is any better. In fact, it's proven that the composting programs with the very small amount of contamination, the environmental benefit is much better. And like I said before, job creation is better. So it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than the option. And where that material is going right now is to landfills and incinerators, and it's really creating environmental problems.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thanks. If you answered this already, I'm sorry. But what is this? How is this policy used?
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Thiessen. This is again a state policy that just is a hierarchy of preferences. I think there's no mandate in this policy. There's no financial impact to this policy, but it's really, I look at it as a guideline to the state as a whole, but particularly the solid waste stakeholders, in terms of what we feel as a state legislature are the better and more preferable ways to deal with waste in terms of the environment. And so this simply pulls really, when you look at this in terms of a line, a lineup, this moves up closer to the top of the line, these materials that are currently landfilled and incinerated, but can be very safely composted, as Ms. Hubbard said. So it's really a policy guideline, and it's not a regulation, it's not a mandate, and there's certainly no state funding associated with the hierarchy.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think maybe my question is kind of along the lines of what Representative Thiessen was asking, but I always try to think about these ideas and initiatives in terms of what does it mean for the average household and what I'm discarding and how that would address that. So from what I hear you saying, there's nothing that's going to necessarily change what the garbage hauler that I contract with is going to do, but maybe encourage options for consumers. Am I hearing you correctly in that way?
Representative Loon, I think you have a very good and clear understanding about what we're trying to do here. We want to encourage more of these initiatives such that exist in my district, in my neighborhood, others that have been outlined, I think, pretty relatively close to you in the western suburbs and the school-based initiatives. I think this will really say to people who are considering these that, yes, we think this is a good way to go. And, again, ours is completely voluntary, and it could give municipalities and counties another option. I think it sends a really clear message about where we want to be now and in the future in terms of adjusting our hierarchy and our policies to the realities that are happening on the ground. And one of the things that was so impressive to me is that, you know, within a year, half of the households in a neighborhood are participating voluntarily and are very, very enthusiastic about this. As was mentioned, we have compost captains as we have block captains, and they meet regularly and they talk to their neighbors about this. And I think that if this were offered in many other communities across the state, that it would be equally enthusiastically welcome.
Representative Loon.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Representative Hornstein, are you aware, or maybe any of your testifiers, of any of the current refuse companies offering to remove this, like in a separate can from your house? You would have your, you know, maybe compostable and then recyclables and other waste. I'd actually asked my waste hauler about that, and we discussed sort of the cost versus consumer attractiveness, because I assume a lot of other people may be in the same boat. You're not necessarily have the time or interest of creating your own compost pile, and maybe some neighborhoods are going to do that and some aren't, but you can roll it in a can down to the end of your driveway and it does the same thing. A lot of people may be interested in that. Is that being pioneered here in the state anywhere?
Well, I'll have Ms. Hubbard address it in large part, but I can just say simply, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, that I think that is the beauty and the success story that we're putting forward here, is that in fact, many people are putting it in a cart and rolling it down their driveway once a week to be picked up. And I think that's why we've had such enthusiasm for that. But in terms of your specific question about the haulers and the options that they provide, I'll have Ms. Hubbard answer that.
Ms. Hubbard.
Chair, Representative. Eureka Recycling is a nonprofit organization, but we've run recycling collection and composting collection programs for many years, so we offer that service to commercial customers in Minneapolis, and we're kicking that off in St. Paul very shortly. We're working with the city of St. Paul, and so this summer we'll be launching the beginnings of that project in St. Paul. The city of Minneapolis provides that service inland in Hills, and they're looking at expanding. I believe the last time I talked to Susan Young, who runs those programs, she expects to be citywide by the end of 2012 or 2013. I think 2012. And I know that there are several other companies. Randy Sanitation and Dick Sanitation are some companies. I believe that Waste Management was offering that service, and I just recently heard that they're no longer offering that service. But there are many, many companies that are offering the service of collecting composting from both commercial operations and from residential homes. So.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, we do have a couple other testifiers. Thank you, Ms. Hubbard. We have Mr. Doug Carnival and Ms. Julie Ketchum. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And if you could state your names for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival from the McGranchy Carnival Law Firm, Minneapolis, representing the National Solid Waste Management Association, and along with me, Julie Ketchum.
And I am the Director of Government Affairs for Waste Management in Minnesota, Iowa, and Kansas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I could begin. The National Solid Waste Management Association, my client, appreciates the opportunity to comment on this legislation that changes the current solid waste management hierarchy by deleting the terms food waste and inserting the phrase source-separated compostable materials. This change broadens the materials that can be composted beyond the current yard waste and food waste categories to include source-separated compostable materials. In so doing, the change to the hierarchy encourages the composting of a broader category of new materials before regulations have been established. Therefore, changing the hierarchy now, in our opinion, is premature. Any legislative consideration should wait until the MPCA concludes a rulemaking process to deal with this. I should also add that despite the comments that you heard earlier, we're not aware of any variances or special approvals that are needed to proceed forward with the projects that are going on right now. As a matter of fact, their continuation is not something that's prohibited at all by the current hierarchy, and frankly, in our opinion, and according to the law, there is no barrier that exists right now to them continuing to do what they're doing. So that's certainly something that we don't think needs to be changed to permit them to do something that they currently feel that they're not permitted to do. Supporting our position, frankly, that this is premature, is a recently completed MPCA Solid Waste Stakeholder Report, which states that, quote, the MPCA should continue to develop and improve appropriate rules and regulations for compost and anaerobic digestion facility siting, processing operations, best management practices, et cetera, taking into account the environmental impacts of such management methods, unquote. The report then goes on to state that, quote, MPCA should proceed with continued evaluation of regulatory requirements in other states, assessment of environmental impacts of composting, and the use of this information in developing the rules, end of quote. Frankly, our primary concern with this change to the hierarchy is related to the fact that composting of various waste materials is a rapidly evolving issue, with new studies underway that will provide new and additional information about the regulatory controls needed to protect the environment. The composting feedstock is important. In other words, the types of waste materials that are mixed together and their quantities affect the characterization slash components in the emissions, runoff, and leachate generated from a compost site. We want to ensure that a thoughtful and thorough regulatory process takes these issues into account and produces a clear regulatory framework to the establishment of a state policy that encourages composting of a broader universe of waste materials. Lastly, Mr. Chair, NSWMA wants to be clear that we support composting. With several of our members collecting organics in pilot composting programs, and on a national scale owning and operating several composting operations. In addition, significant investments are being made in innovative technologies, such as anaerobic digestion of organic material, that go beyond the production of compost to produce much higher value renewable energy and biofuels. These technologies collect and process the gas that is generated through biodegradation that would otherwise escape to the atmosphere and open air windrow composting. Again, our position is that the legislature should wait until the MPCA completes rulemaking before the legislature changes this state policy with regard to solid waste management hierarchy. We're eager to work with Representative Hornstein to see if we can achieve his objectives without changing the hierarchy at this time prematurely, and don't see this as any barrier, the current statute as any barrier to those folks who are doing this from proceeding forward, and a change isn't necessary at this time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like Ms. Ketchum to make some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival, and Ms. Ketchum.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd just like to elaborate a little bit on the history of this issue. in the state of Minnesota, but then also in other states like California that are kind of leading the way on composting. And then also to answer some of the questions that came up on the hierarchy, what does this do? What does this change to the hierarchy do, and are there any implications with that? So just to start off, waste management, we have been involved in some of the pilot projects here. We have run collection programs. We were the first hauler that actually worked with the school districts in Dakota County. There was an article last fall on our work with those school districts. So we are very supportive of source-separated organics and working to compost those materials. We did discontinue some of our curbside collection programs, and the reason we did that was because of lack of participation and lack of volume. And so we had very low amounts of food waste being set out in these curbside programs. I think it's great that Linden Hills has a lot of motivation for this and that they're working on it, but our experience in some of the neighborhoods has been a very low participation rate. So you then have to weigh the fuel use and emissions generated from separate collection of this material, and is that a wise thing to do? Should you run a separate trucks out, and what is the carbon footprint of doing that? So that's why we discontinued curbside collection of this material. However, waste management has invested in anaerobic digestion. We recently purchased Harvest Power, which has three anaerobic digestion facilities nationally. And earlier this week, actually, we announced an investment in Enerchem, which is a company based in Canada. Those anaerobic digesters take compost and they go to the next level. So they are actually producing biofuels from organics. So you're not getting a low value compostable, but you're getting a biofuel. So waste management does support organics composting. This issue with the hierarchy, though, and PCA involvement with this issue, the history on that, PCA held a stakeholder process for 9 months. They just concluded it this fall. This was a major issue, composting, and what is going on with composting, what studies and research have been conducted. There are a lot of studies that have been done, and a variety of them show very high levels of VOCs and other contaminants, and suggest that there's a need for greater environmental control at these facilities. So PCA is conducting pilot projects. They have several sites where they are collecting the stormwater runoff, the leachate. They are looking at chemicals that are in that leachate, in the water, in the stormwater, and they're looking at best management practices for those sites and for composting generally. Statements were made about people supporting composting. Well, what do you mean? Do you mean organic? Do you mean food waste? Do you mean yard waste? Or are you talking about adding in paper? Once you start adding in those other items, you're changing what the output is going to be, the end result, what kind of emissions are generated, what's in the stormwater runoff, what's in the leachate. So PCA needs to look at that. Other states are. California in particular has conducted several studies, and they are in the process of developing rules based on those findings. And some of them, especially in areas where air quality is poor, there is great concern with composting, and they're requiring blankets to be put over those compost sites, or requiring cover material to be added to those sites to ensure that those air emissions are controlled. So what does this change do? It sounds simple, but what it does really is it encourages a practice that's not yet regulated. And so we need the PCA, through the Administrative Procedures Act, to go through this process, allow for people to comment, allow to be involved, and affect the outcome of that process. We need to have a well thought out regulatory framework in place so we can move forward. But there is a lot of evidence out there, a lot of studies being conducted, and you can either look at one or you can look at all of them and try to get a good idea of what's really going on with organics. With that,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gardner.
Well, this is for either testifier. Well, the PCA already has a permitting process now, though. They can permit a source separated composting facility now. It's just under the same regulations and the regulatory structure as MSW composting, isn't that right?
It depends on what you're, Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I think it depends on what you're doing and how you're doing it and what you're composting. So there are MSW garbage composting rules. Scaled down from that a bit, if you took out the plastics out of the waste stream, that's probably what you're talking about as far as composting. So if I look at my garbage can and take out the plastic, you're allowing that waste material really to go to a compost site. You know, so the question is, does that material need to be regulated at a higher level? Do we need to be protecting the environment? Do we need to be careful with siting or financial assurance for that type of waste? So those are the questions. And so when you get down to organics and looking at food waste, yard waste, non-recyclable paper, we all don't know how the PCA might respond to that. I've heard a proposal on an anaerobic digester where, I don't know how true this was, but the statement was made that they're being transferred or they're being permitted as a transfer station. So I think it's an unknown. My answer to your question is I don't think anybody knows, and I think part of the rationale there that supports our position is that we really want, you know, a level playing field from a regulatory standpoint so we can all go into this and support it and all have an opportunity to affect it through the rulemaking process.
Okay. Any other questions?
We need to get going.
Thank you. Seeing none, thank you very much. Representative Hornstein. Like to make any final comments?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate the opportunity. This was a wonderful discussion, and I just want to make a very brief concluding comment just to say, you know, rulemaking and the hierarchy are not mutually exclusive. As Representative Gardner said, if someone wants to move forward with a facility, there's a rigorous permitting process at the PCA. My understanding is even in the stakeholder process, there were some recommendations from that group to move this higher up in the hierarchy. So this is good, solid policy. We don't need to slow this down, you know, with rulemaking. That will happen. That will take its course. But it's not at all mutually exclusive of what we're doing here. And so, members, I think this is good, solid environmental policy, and I would urge your support for this bill.
Okay. And seeing no other questions, I will renew the motion that House File 3061 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you,
Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda, House File 3067. Representative Hansen. And Representative Hansen, if
thank
you,
you
would like to move your bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3067.
Okay. Representative Hansen moves House File 3067 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. So Representative Hansen to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3067 is an agency bill brought to me by the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I have with me this afternoon or this evening Ms. Julie Blackburn and Jim Hartle from the Board of Water and Soil Resources to describe the bill.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Blackburn and Mr. Hartle. If you could state your names, please.
Thank you. My name is Julie Blackburn. I'm the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I just wanted to re-familiarize this committee with one of Bowser's requirements. We are the agency that is responsible for review and oversight of all local water management plans. And with that, we look at the process that we go through in or the local units of government go through for their plans, and we try to look for ways to make it as easy, as streamlined, and responsive as possible in order for them to spend less time planning and more time doing. So with that, I have with me the Metro Area Supervisor, Mr. Jim Hartle. And this bill, just to preface it before you get started explaining the particular issues with it or the recommendations from it, this only is affecting Metro watershed management organizations. It is not particular to any of the other rest of the state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim, and he's going to explain the particulars of this bill.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Hartle.
Thank you, Julie. Jim Hartle with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Mr. Chair, committee members, as Julie mentioned, this revision is only pertinent to the seven county metro area watershed management organizations. It's to streamline the plan amendment process. The proposed changes would basically shift a second review period, which is now a 45-day review period, only for state agencies. It would shift that into the Bowser approval process. And by so doing, it would basically cut about 3 months out of the review process. Right now, the big change that's occurring over the last few years is the review agencies are now involved up front at the beginning of the planning process, and then they're involved during the planning process. So now what we're seeing is when the 60-day review is done, which is the first review, there's not as many comments as there used to be. And the second review period, this 45-day review period, largely hasn't resulted in many comments being generated. So we feel that these can this review period can be removed. The other item in the revision is to streamline or shorten the time period to which a public hearing could be held. Previously, it was had to be held over 30 days, but less than 45 days. It was only a 15-day time period for a watershed management organization to hold the hearing. With this change, they could hold the hearing within 15 days, or they could do it as they used to, or they could take a longer period of time to have the hearing. We feel giving them a longer period of time to have a hearing sometimes is desirable, so that they go back and make more of the changes that are being requested by the commenters. Lastly, the review agencies have all agreed to these changes, and the watershed management organizations in the seven county metropolitan area are really begging for these changes. They've been asking for these changes for a long time. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. I see none. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I think the agency staff did an excellent job, and I would renew my motion.
Okay. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3067 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Our bill is passed. Okay, next we have House File 3207, Representative Saylor. And Representative Saylor, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move my bill and have it recommended to pass and move on to the General Register.
Representative Saylor moves that House File 3207 be recommended to pass, and now we have down that it was going to be referred to the Committee on Finance. Would that be correct?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I misspoke. Yes.
Sure.
Correct.
Okay. So Representative Saylor moves that House File 3207 be recommended to pass and sent or referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Saylor, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to me by the Nordic Ski Association of Minnesota, which is basically a group of volunteers that groom and maintain cross-country ski trails throughout the state of Minnesota. The only funding that these groups get is through money that comes from the ski pass. And as I say, they came to me this year asking for a hike in their own rates, just as the folks with the horse ski pass, or not ski, the horse trail pass did a couple of years ago. And I think a couple of other things I just wanted to mention about the changes in there. Actually, a three-year pass is designed for convenience of skiers, and it evens out some of the ups and downs that we have of weather in Minnesota. You might have a bad year and then another year that is an improvement. And so this helps to average things out and, again, work a little bit for that convenience. The last increase was in 2005. I also wanted to mention that in my bill, there's not only the portion about raising the fees as requested by the association, but also a piece that talks about removing the use or the need for a pass when organizations such as a school group, a 4-H group, the Boy Scouts, whatever, if they're having a youth group that needs to come out and they're trying to encourage health and good activities by students, oftentimes they have to look far and wide to get enough parents to come along, and sometimes those parents are not skiers, but they need to be with them. What this would do is this actually allows them all to be out there on the ski trails, and if these people are not likely to be using the trails again, they're there basically just to make sure that these students have an opportunity to learn a little bit about skiing. And as in the case of some school groups that have worked with this in the past, to experience another form of exercise. And the other piece that I would like to mention is that the ski groups and cross-country skiing in northern Minnesota is really a key part of our tourism. And we're always looking for ways to extend our tourism in northern Minnesota, actually throughout the whole state. And if this helps us with our shoulder season, so to speak, and with our winter season, it's very crucial that we have ways of finding activities for people to come to other areas in Minnesota, specifically our resorts in northern Minnesota. So I do have some testifiers here today. And the first one that I would like to have is Ben Pop. And we have also, I think Ben is the first one that's going to speak right now. So here he is.
Thank you. My name is Ben Pop, and I am the executive director of the Sisu Nordic Ski Foundation, which is a nonprofit in St. Paul, as well as the owner of Endurance Athlete, which is a coaching service that works mainly with cross-country skiers. And I guess the reason I'm here mostly is that I'm worried to some degree. We work with thousands of skiers. A majority of them are kids. And the ski trails that we use, mainly in the East Metro, are all maintained by volunteers at this point because they're the lack of funding we have to maintain them. We're running out of the funds that we get. And so I see these kids. We have a lot of opportunities to go out and ski, and a lot of it is because these trails are maintained and we can go out and ski. So we would like to see these trails maintained so we can continue to use them. I feel fortunate to have been able to ski since age 3. And I think the age of exposure is critical. And as we look around and see Minnesota not getting any fitter and healthier, for me, from a coaching standpoint and working with these children, it's really important to have our ski trails maintained. And for a nominal fee increase, I think that can help be insured. So, thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Pop. Any questions for Mr. Pop? Seeing none, next, you could state your name for the tape, please. And position.
Yep, John Munger with the City of Lakes Nordic Ski Foundation. I think you've probably heard what the grant and aid program is about to some extent, but it's just skiers paying in order to have decent trails through the state to ski on. It's not a system where you have other tax revenues coming in. This is just a pay-in, pay-out type of system. And what you get with it is a system of ski trails throughout the entire state that attracts people from other states to ski here and brings kids and families out to do something really constructive in a Minnesota winter. And we all know that Minnesota winters can have a bad reputation. This is an opportunity to give us a good reputation, have something good come out of it. Even if you saw the Olympics just the last couple weeks, several of the cross-country ski athletes, and in fact, you know, the best female athlete was from Minnesota, and it's because of programs like this that we have those athletes competing there. But this is keeping people healthy throughout the year. So what's the problem? The problem now is that we have a real insufficient amount of money coming in in order to maintain the trails that we have. There's some 45 clubs that operate on a volunteer-driven basis. These clubs are just looking to get their cost of operations back. We've fallen way behind on that now because there's only about $225,000 in revenue coming in each year that gets redistributed out to those clubs. That's not nearly sufficient to even pay for the basic grooming equipment. And that equipment has become more expensive over the years. Some of you might be familiar with the skate skiing that's come along over the past 20 years or so. That requires quite a bit more of grooming technology and cost to do that grooming because it's much wider and you have both the classic track and the skating. And so costs have gone up considerably, but the revenue has been stagnant. And so that's the real problem. But again, the solution is to look within the ski community. Ben and I and Tully and so forth, we all represent the ski community. The ski community is overwhelmingly for this legislation. We, to put it bluntly, want to pay more because we want to get a better product back out of it, and we think that's going to be for the good of the entire state. So that's where we're at. Just for a little perspective on the cost, we're looking to raise the annual fee from $15 per person to $20 per person. The Three Rivers Park District currently charges $50 per person and has had an enormous amount of success with that program because they're able to offer real quality back. So that's the gist of what this proposal is. And I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Munger. And you have a very familiar last name. I assume your father was the former chair of this committee, Willard?
I'm not that old.
father?
my middle name is Willard. My grandfather was Willard. So.
Okay. Yeah. So, great. Any questions for Mr. Munger? Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Munger. Mr. Munger, Representative Saylor, and maybe Mr. Pop, too, what percent, are there other skiers out there that use the trails beyond your clubs? How many total members are represented by your clubs relative, and what is that number relative to the total numbers of skiers that use the trails?
Well, Mr. Munger.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Nordic Ski Foundation that I represent over Minneapolis, we have about 10,000 people on our mailing list and some 400 members or so. But the users for these trails in general are not members of clubs or anything like that. They're your family. You decide to go out to ski at a park that's covered by the Minnesota Ski Pass. You purchase that pass for $15 in order to cover your skiing that day. And the same thing with me if I go out there. Now the club is just organized to get those trails groomed and have a place to ski. So there might be, say, in Brainerd, the Brainerd Ski Club, and they organize that club, own a piece of grooming equipment, and volunteers go around and groom the trails. And it's to cover those costs of that Brainerd Ski Club that the ski pass is existing for. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Yeah. Representative Joskowski.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The follow-up question would be a different question. Have your groups or has the sport generally applied for some of the legacy dollars that were passed in Constitution in 2008? I'm trying to remember. Maybe Representative Wagenius can remind us. It's 14.25% or 19.75% of $280 million. Are some of these dollars becoming available for your trails as was outlined in the Constitution?
I'm going to defer to Representative Saylor on that, but I think the answer is that those are for capital improvements as opposed to ongoing maintenance, but I'm not.
Representative Chair, Representative Truskowski, no, they have not applied to legacy funding for trails. This is pretty much a user fee, and it goes for maintaining the trails so that it keeps, you know, that funding for other things. Unless there are any other comments from DNR regarding that, no, they haven't applied for those.
Okay. Representative Truskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would they qualify? Does anyone know? Is there any reason they wouldn't qualify?
Do we have anyone from the DNR here? Yeah, answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm a member of the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association as well, mm-hmm. and there has been some discussion with DNR representatives about that, I know, at one of the meetings, but my sense was that, as I indicated, it was not available for operating expenses, but I'm not an expert on that.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
The language says support, so it would be available for operating. I mean, the constitutional language uses the word support, parks and trails. I think it would be helpful for this committee to put in our packets for next week the analysis that DNR combined with our fiscal analyst, Jim Reinholz, did of the outstanding need for money for parks and trails, because what it shows, and more graphically than I can show, is that I believe it's a $32 million deferred maintenance backlog right now, and that the state trail system, if we were to put $20 million of bonding in each bonding cycle, it would take us till, I think, 2044 to complete the authorized trail system that we have right now. So it's does that give you a sign of a picture of what's going on? It probably doesn't, but I think it maybe just to put that in people's packets and they can just see it. And we have a similar sheet for trails, for parks, and it would just give people a good overview with one piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Healthy dose of reality,
yes.
Maybe.
So. Yes.
Representative Gardner.
I had a question for the author or the testifier. Are you worried this money is just going to get swiped by us or somebody else? I mean, I'm getting emails about snowmobile fund money and... Are we increasing something that's just going to disappear?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, I think everyone is concerned about that. No matter which organization you are with at this point in time, everyone is looking at the concern with unallotments and other things that we may end up doing legislatively. I think everyone's concerned about whether their funding will be secure or not. And one of the reasons that the Ski Association brought this is to make sure that they do have some funding for these purposes. But as I understand it, the ATV and the snowmobile portions were removed. I should let the DNR speak to that piece in particular. But I think everybody's worried about losing some funding, and this is basically just addressing the fact that we have a need for it. And I know that there are some other provisions in other DNR bills that will be coming forward that are a little bit separate from this. So we're just addressing the possible change here in fees as per asked for by the Ski Association.
Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quick question. On a percentage basis, these are pretty large increases, 36% increases. Where do the numbers come from, and how did you arrive at the increases?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative. The problem is, and the reason they seem like large increases, is that it's been a number of years since since these fees have increased. So you've had it's a step system essentially. So I think 2003 was the last time they were increased, And ever since then, you've had just a flat fee structure, and now we're just trying to catch up to where we really should have been at all along. So that's where that comes from. And the reality is we actually wanted to have, and we're pushing for, a higher increase, because in order to be to the levels that you really need to maintain these clubs, you need quite a bit more dollars in there. Just for a little perspective on that, the Snowmobile Associations that are able to do the gas tax to recover, you know, they're operating at well over 10 times the amount of revenue for their clubs that we are. So, and yet we're still able to make these things work. So having a 33% increase on what is right now very minimal is not much.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, I'll move to the next testifier. Thank you, Mr. Munger. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the
representative, debate, please. Excuse me. My name is Tolly Vollen, from St. Cloud, a member of the Nordic Ski Club of Central Minnesota, and also a board member of the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association. And I've skied for a number of years, but most of my skiing is done on GIA or Grant and Aid trails in the St. Cloud area, such as the Greystone Trails on the grounds of the Minnesota Correctional Facility, that's outside the facility, of course, or at Wildwood, west of St. Cloud. I also do a fair amount of skiing in the Bemidji area at Lake Bemidji State Park, Mobile Maze, Three Island County Park, and Buena Vista Ski Area, all being Grant and Aid trail systems totaling close to 50 miles of groomed ski trails. Supporting this bill makes sense for the following reasons from a skier's perspective. It's a modest increase and won't be hard for we skiers to adjust to. It should, and I believe will, result in more regularly and better groomed trails for more enjoyable skiing. This bill, if passed, will result in more revenues being generated to help ski clubs meet the increased costs of trail grooming, such as snowmobile upkeep, gas and oil, insurance. Our club, I think, pays $2,000 of insurance there with the Nordic Ski Club in St. Cloud. Repairing grooming equipment depreciation, and in many cases, labor. This will also help to make improvements to trails which have been postponed to save more funds for grooming. These ski trail improvements projects are reimbursable under the GIA system. These added revenues could allow new trail systems to be enrolled in the GIA program. I think in the last 7 or 8 years, we've only had, I believe, 3 new trail systems added. If passed, this bill will help to promote a healthful, wholesome, family-oriented pastime for children, youth, and adults enjoying a lifelong activity. And I've seen a lot of groups using, back to the Greystone Trails, the high schools, 3 high schools from St. Cloud, teams, that is, bona fide high school league-sponsored teams. St. Cloud State University's Nordic Ski Team uses those trails quite extensively, as do many other citizens in the greater St. Cloud area. In closing, the Grant and Aid Minnesota Ski Pass is overdue for an increase, and we skiers are willing to foot the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vollen. Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next, I think we have Mr. Darby Nelson. Welcome, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Darby Nelson, member of the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association Board. Interestingly enough, what goes around comes around. Back as a greenhorn freshman legislator in 1983, I was approached by ski clubs, and they said, Nelson, we really need a means of funding our operation. Would you carry a bill that established the grant and aid program and established it through the fee system? So I carried the bill, and here I am 25 years later. I never expected to be back talking about the ski bill. But you've heard most, I think, of what is appropriate with the earlier folks who testified. What I'd really like to do is just highlight a couple things. First off, I think in your packets should be a list or a set of support letters. The list is reasonably long. I can quickly rattle through it. The Minnesota Nordic Ski Association, the Duluth Ski Club, the Bemidji Area Ski Club, the Brainerd Nordic Ski Club, the City of Lakes Nordic Ski Foundation, the Moravasa Lopa Northern Lights Ski Club in Itasca County, Itasca Tour Bike Run Club in Park Rapids, the Nordic Ski Club, as you've heard of St. Cloud, North Star Ski Touring Club of Minneapolis. I talked with the Ely Ski Club just two nights ago, and their letter was coming, but I didn't get it in time to bring it in. So there are across the entire state. In fact, the second piece that should be in your packet is a flip side that shows on one side by dots where these ski clubs are located geographically. You see they're absolutely all over the snow belt of the state. And on the flip side of that sheet is an identification of the clubs. And you can see typically there's a county or a city or in one case a township is responsible sort of as the administrator of the grant from DNR. Beyond that, you know, I think what's happening right now is the same thing that happened 25 years ago. Skiers coming to us saying, this sport is really fun, but it really requires groomed trails. We know there's no money in St. Paul to do it. Let us pay the way. And I think that's what it really boils down to fundamentally. We'd really like to have the money to see those trails expanded. And, you know, we've got health issues that Ben mentioned. We'd like to get people outside more. Cross-country skiing is a great means by which that can happen. Tourism. I just spent in the company of 8,000 folks over in Wisconsin on the weekend an event that's called the Birkebeiner. And let me tell you, 8,000 people, families, little kids, all kinds, millions of dollars brought into the city of Hayward, Wisconsin because of cross-country skiing. So with that, I'll stop and see if there are questions.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
Well, I really don't have a question, so I just had a comment on the whole thing. If it's appropriate, I could go ahead otherwise.
Sure. Well, if there's no other any other questions for Mr. Nelson first? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Nelson. And Representative Dill, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair Eakin. And as you see, you may notice I co-authored the bill, second author on the bill. I'm actually a trail administrator for a snowmobile trail grant, but as well a ski trail grant. Now, I've only been on cross-country skis once in my entire life, and it wasn't pretty. I weighed 140 pounds more at that time, so that really made it unpretty, and that was up at Ely at the Nordic Ski Club up there. But these folks, if you'll remember a few years ago, I authored with Representative Hackbarth and others to increase and to create that trail sticker for snowmobiles because we were in the exact same dilemma that the skiers are in today. You know, a grooming tractor right now, by the way, we don't have our community has a ski trail. It was developed through grant and aid through this same program, but we don't even get a grant for it. We don't even bother getting the grant. We just groom it for free with our, and we use a $200,000 grooming tractor to groom it. It's a huge investment, and I don't think most of your ski trails have that kind of equipment, but it's because we have such a large system that we have that kind of equipment, and we use it to groom the trails. If the ski club were still in existence, which they aren't because the snowmobile club kind of took over the responsibility as a favor to them, they would be grooming with a skidoo and a little pull behind trail setter, which many of them are doing. And even with that, they can't afford to do it on a $1,000 grant. That's what we used to get when we were doing the trail just a couple of years ago, $1,000 for an entire season. And I just really suggest that if you look at the snowmobiles as an example, since it's on snow, the result, the outcome, has been phenomenal since we passed that trail sticker. The clubs, now in this instance the ski clubs, but in the instance of the trail sticker for snowmobiles, those clubs are now on sound financial footing. They're able to hire people. we actually have a payroll where we have five groomer operators that make $15 an hour all winter grooming trail. We actually have people working because of that program. And it's really successful. Now, I'm not suggesting that the ski pass thing accomplishes those same type of levels, but it's really needed, and that's the reason that because I have firsthand experience at it, and it's a great addition. I know that at American and Orr, where I live, that there's routinely that cross-country skiers stay there and eat in all the restaurants, and they come just because there's a ski trail, and it needs to be groomed, and it needs to be done right, and the people who do it don't need to be having bake sales every other weekend and all these little ancillary events to try and raise enough money to make it through. And so that's the reason I supported the bill.
Thank you, Representative Dill. And we have one other testifier. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. And I'll just speak rather briefly about this particular bill from a tourism perspective. And as you all know, those of you who have heard me before, tourism is a huge industry in the state of Minnesota. It's an $11 billion industry. 15% of all our state sales tax comes from the leisure and hospitality industry. And when we're talking about winter, 24%, roughly a quarter of all that economic impact does come from the winter. And this represents travel of all kinds, but in a good year like this one, travel to ski is a very important part of the mix. Earlier, I think one of you were asking some questions on statistics for the state of Minnesota as a whole, and 6.3% of Minnesota's population participate in cross-country skiing, according to a 2009 report prepared by the Recreational Trails Users Association. And the total specific impact of cross-country skiing, as was kind of talked about earlier, includes about $41.1 million in trip spending and $3.9 million in state and local passes. And as you've just heard, the fees from this program goes to help support to groom the trails. And from a tourism perspective, the amount that people have to pay, even with the increase, it's a great deal. And this is just anecdotal. My nephew was just telling me, you mentioned the Birkebeiner. He just came back from the Birkebeiner. And I asked him, what do you think about this bill? And he says, as an avid cross-country skier, the little bit of extra that he would have to pay for a pass, an annual pass or a daily pass, it's certainly worth it for the quality of trails that we have in the state, not only as a particular user, but also the ability to bring other races to Minnesota, races that we currently have and perhaps more, and that's economic impact. So when snow conditions are good, there's a definite tourism attraction that generates travelers from throughout the state, and cross-country skiing is one of those things that helps make our state unique and keep our tourism industry strong. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Edmond. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thanks again. And there are no other testifiers, so Representative Saylor, Representative McNamara has
I just have a couple questions for the author and potentially for the DNR.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. Representative Saylor, I'm just curious, in your last, on lines 1.2 and 1.21, shall notify the agency with jurisdiction over the cross-country ski trail of the date and time of the activity. It's in regards to students or whatever to be able to be there free. Have you gone over that with the agency? And I'm wondering if the agency could speak to that, the logistics of that.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. Yes, I did meet with DNR about this whole bill. And I think that Bob Meyer would be able to speak to that a little bit as well. Basically, we were using some, moving around some old language from the participants in cross-country ski races, and because we were expanding that to allow some of these youth groups to be involved, that basically is how that ended up being moved down to that spot. And we just talked about making sure that they notify people, which is the same, I believe, Mr. Meyer, as we do for the cross-country ski races, which have been in effect for a number of years.
Welcome, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This language is, as Representative Saylor said, is similar to language we've used previously, basically for enforcement, and so we know people are going to be on the trails at that point in time and who they're associated with. And it's viewed as a recruitment and retention opportunity. I think the clubs and the author brought it forward to allow us to expand to schools and youth groups to require them not to have the permit to do these activities, similar to what we've done with fishing within the state parks and ice fishing within state parks and things like that.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Meyer, in law today it says official school activities are exempt. Why would we add this extra burden of the middle school or the junior high teacher needing to notify the agency, and then do they call St. Paul, or where do they call? I'm trying to figure out why would we be doing this. I'm not sure I understand it. Almost like maybe the author could ask, why would we do this?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Eakin, Representative McNamara. The language here, oftentimes, well, the DNR does not get any of the grant and aid money for our trail operation currently, but you're required to have a sticker. We'll be talking about that situation here in a couple of days. But this would allow that activity, that the nonprofit organization or the event would have to contract that trail organization. So prior to the activity, the organizer of the activity or their representative from the school shall notify the agency with jurisdiction over the cross-country ski trail. So I think the intent here was to clarify this. We weren't involved with the drafting, but we think the language works to actually clarify who the entity needs to be, who the entity that needs to be contacted should be, and how that should work.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Saylor, if this does move beyond this committee, I would recommend that we would question why that would even be there if we already have official school activity. If you're going to include it, the nonprofit, maybe you could clean the language up. But I guess more, Representative Saylor, I would ask you, one of the testifiers talked about this being a modest increase, and I'm just wondering if you would agree that a 38.5% increase for ski passes at a time when we just passed a constitutional amendment for trails and parks that has got millions and millions of dollars in it. If I'm not mistaken, maybe I should just ask Representative Saylor, when was the last increase? I think I remember an increase in this.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I believe it was 2005.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Saylor, that's the way I remember it, too. So at a time when we're finally starting to move this economy forward, we're going to increase after we passed the dedicated sales tax 2 years ago. We had an increase 5 years ago for this. We're going to increase it another 36% for the annual pass, or 38.5% for the three-year pass. Would you agree that that's a modest increase?
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. Actually, these increases, as they were brought to me, were based on past precedents. When these fees were increased in the past, they increased by the same number or the same percentage. And I think the other thing that we need to look at when we consider, you know, raising these fees is, you know, how much actually is it compared to, you know, what's going on, you know, $5 or $15 for 3 years, which actually is less than, you know, purchasing the one-year permits. But I think that the ski group would be very happy to have, you know, all grant and aid trails financed from the legacy money, but I don't think that that's going to happen with any reliability anytime soon. And in the meantime, we have all of these trails that need to be maintained. And as the user group came forward, as they have with other user groups in the past, you know, asking for the increase to maintain what basically is a huge driver for our areas, as Mr. Edmund spoke about, and as I know from personal experience living up in that resort area and how many people actually come up to those trails. And talking about today, I had a constituent, it was completely coincidental, but I had a constituent visiting with me on another issue, and for some reason the topic came up. She brought it up and she said, well, I work up at Buena Vista and we just had the Finlandia, and I'm so glad that we have it because it allowed me to have extra employment. And it was completely unsolicited, but I thought, well, that's really appropriate that it would, you know, come on this particular day. But I don't think that that the fee increase is particularly out of line, since it does follow the past precedents. And in fact, I did actually ask that question when the group brought this to me, and I asked, you know, what did you base this on? And they base it on their past precedents.
I would just ask for a roll call when we go to vote, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. Sure, a roll call has been requested. So, Representative Dill.
Well, I have to add one more thing to this, and I hear what Representative McNamara is saying. When you start one of these programs out, and I started this out in 1984, so however many years, that a long time, and we had people come out of the woodwork to help. I mean, we had volunteers for every imaginable thing you could possibly have, including making hot dogs and chili to bring it out on the trail system for people to eat lunch while they were out there. And then 85 came, and there weren't any hot dogs. And then in 86, there was no chili. In 87, there was no pop. In 88, there was no coffee. In 89, there wasn't anybody. I think you get where I'm going with this. And today, what we have is a standalone system that's underfunded because people have got busy lives. And while they're being very busy in their lives, their kids and their family are down at the local IGA or at a grocery store or a convenience store running in from the car and buying $5 to $10 worth of goodies, pizzas, 8-inch pizzas and pop and candy and renting movies, some of which shouldn't even be rented to kids, and paying all kinds of money for it. And here we're going to still give them the opportunity to be out on a well-maintained groomed trail that there is no volunteer base for, essentially, anymore. And we're going to charge them this little amount. Now, I don't remember it. I have a poor memory when it comes to these fee things. But I'm trying to think that our snowmobile registration was, when we passed the trail sticker, was, I don't know, it's Mr. Potter. How much was the trail, how much is the register of snowmobile when we put the trail sticker on? How much is the three-year registration? 45, and we added on $16 per year for a trail sticker if you bought it at the ELS. So it's a similar percentage, Representative McNamara. And that was the first year out of the box that we take that kind of a percentage. And look at the success that we've had. So you get the drift of where I'm going. I'll be voting yes for this. I don't want to spend people's money, but on the other hand, to quote Representative Wagenius, I mean, this is an outcome that is worthy of having.
Oh, and I think it's important to note that the very people who are going to be paying this are asking for it. Representative McNamara.
Well, to that point, Mr. Chair, as one of the testifiers said, the average cross-country skier supports this. I'm sorry, the average small game hunter would support an increase in that, or the avid fisherman is going to support that. I'm concerned about the everyday cross-country skier that maybe lost their job, had an increase in 05, and now we're going to hit them with another 38.5%. I understand the avid people. They like it when all the regular people pay the bills so they can enjoy it that much better. This should be for everybody, not only the avid ones, not only the ones that are out there using it all the time. We should be thinking of the everyday regular people that are maybe only doing it a couple times a year, and this is a significant, significant increase for them.
And maybe I could ask a question. Has there been any opposition from the cross-country skiers to this bill?
Mr. Chair, no. And I have actually asked outside of the group of people that, you know, the avid skiers, because I wanted to address that issue. And so I actually have asked people outside of that, and I've asked people in towns what they thought about it, and they all thought it was a good idea. You know, even those that said, well, it costs some more money, but it's a value to me. I want this to be in good shape for our kids. We have families that maybe fall into that category that Representative McNamara was talking about, that bring their little kids up, and they're out there every weekend with these little stair-step kids coming out there. And, of course, they don't pay for anybody that's under 16, so it's very much the family activity. And people do use this from all walks of life. And I haven't heard any complaints to answer your question.
Okay. And Mr. Munger, did you have?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, just to answer your, you know, kind of distinction between avid skiers and your average person, it's the average person, the kind of person that goes out once or twice a year, that this bill really helps. You know, I'm an avid skier. I'm going to find the good skiing, or I'm good enough skier that I don't care. But when my mom or dad, who are retirees, go out and my mom can barely stand up on skis as it is, if those trails aren't groomed when she goes out there, she's just not going to go. They and people like them are all for this. This is not some dramatic increase. You know, if it was going from $1,000 to $1,400, yeah, I mean, that's a 40% increase in an already big number. This is going from $15 to $20 for a year. When you look at that on a per day basis, you're talking about, you know, pennies a day to go cross country skiing.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, Representative Saylor, would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to renew my motion that House File 3207 be passed and sent to Environment Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Saylor renews her motion that House File 3207 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. And a roll call has been requested, so clerk will take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bigham? Representative Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Dill?
Yep.
Representative Droszkowski?
No.
Representative Eakin?
Yes.
Representative Falk?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Hackbarth? Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Junkie?
Aye.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Yes.
Representative Saylor?
Yes.
Representative Sterner?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen?
Yeah.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 12 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. Next, Representative Dill, we have House File 2338. Representative Dill, would you like to move the bill?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 2838 and talk about something we can't afford that happens to be coming from the Republicans. I think this is a very interesting bill to have here today. An $18 million plus expenditure on a new state park, of which there are already 10 state parks in my legislative district, but yet I'm here today to support a bill.
Okay.
This puts me in a very strange situation because since I've been in the legislature, I've been supporting no additional purchase of state lands in counties where there are at least more than 50% already publicly owned. And St. Louis County is a 60 plus percent, Lake is 82%, and Cook is 91%, but yet here we are, here we go again. So with that, I'm supporting my own bill, mainly because they have given us the allure that there are going to be 400,000 tourists come to this community in the first year. And this is a huge thing to that community, if in fact that happens. So what this bill does, Section 1, back in 2008, I believe it was, it established that the DNR could pay to purchase the land, which is now going to become known as the Lake Vermilion State Park, and that they would be able to, if necessary, to pay up to 12% over and above the appraisal that the state has done. Well, they had the appraisal done, and the appraisal, certainly by the company, U.S. Steel, was much, much higher than what the state's plus 12% was. So the deal was dead. Except that the governor continued to work to add more public land to my district and to spend more and more money on public land for parks that we really can't afford because we have over $100 million in deferred maintenance in our park system. And, I mean, it's a very perplexing situation that Representative Wagenius has very eloquently explained to our Environment Finance Committee, and someday we're going to have to get our arms around it. Whether we quit acquiring new parks or whether we don't acquire new parks, it's an ongoing problem. But what the Section 1 of the bill does is remove the statutory cap that was put in 2008 of 12% and essentially allow the state to pay any amount that they want. or no, up to $18 million, I'm sorry, up to $18 million for the property. Now, if I recall, we appropriated $20 million in a bonding bill, so they have the money, in fact, to pay for this at $18 million. U.S. Steel is also going to get some type of a federal tax credit because the amount that's actually being paid is a higher amount, but they're taking that as some deduction that I don't understand and isn't addressed in the bill. So basically, the Section 1 removes the 12% caps. Section 2 says that upon enactment of this bill, that the Sudan underground mine, which already exists on Lake Vermilion, will then become a part of the Lake Vermilion State Park. And Section 3 gives the reviser instructions to list the history of the Tower Sudan, or, actually it's the Sudan Underground Mine State Park, under the listing of the Vermilion State Park. So those are the three components of the bill, and it's rather straightforward. It will accomplish the goal of getting this land bought, and as you know, we are going to struggle in the future with appropriations to develop this park, but I suppose you have to take one step before you can take another step. So that is the bill. I'll answer questions, and I'd ask for your support. Although, I find myself in a very awkward situation.
And just to make it official, Representative Dell does move House File 2338. He recommended it pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Representative Ogenius.
Thank you. Representative Dell, the merging with the Sudan brings up an interesting issue for me, because Sudan has become kind of what I call famous in its own right because of the mine and because of the really superb science that's going on in that mine. So it's become known not just in our community, but in a much broader community. Been identified as Sudan. How do you see that playing out in the future?
Representative Dale.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, the bill is 2838, and for the record, you transposed the numbers.
Oh.
Which is, I don't know what.
My dyslexia was kicking in.
I just happened to catch that.
thank you.
Well, that's a very good question, Representative Ogenius, Mr. Chair, and members. You know, the Sudan State Park has been a research mecca. At least the mine shaft. Now, the state park part has not been a mecca of anything other than some beautiful shoreline and controversy because of the Finnish boathouses that are located on the lake that are leased to private entities that originally built them decades ago. and Representative Genius, I think you're right. There's some sensitivity ought to be given to that, and in this bill, it talks about, it says, in the next issue of Minnesota statutes, the reviser shall incorporate the statutory history of the Sudan Underground Mine under the listing for Lake Vermilion State Park. I think we're trying to, essentially what this does is it makes one state park out of two and makes as a part of the history, and I'm not sure that gets us all the way there in every instance. Now, apparently the community is satisfied with that. I've received no input at all, one way or the other, on the language of the bill, the way it's written. But I tend to agree with you. It's very famous. And in fact, the first iron mining in Minnesota was done in that area and in that mine. And there's people that lost their lives there. The first train to the Lake Superior was built from that community out to the lake shore. There's a lot of history there. And as it says, the history will be so reflected. But some of the identity will likely be lost as a part of this transition.
Representative Ogenius.
Representative Dill, I just wonder if we could think about some way of figuring out how to keep that Sudan mine name important. Because I think we all agree it is, and just I don't know what I'm asking right now. But it's just something that I wish we would think about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Genius, I think I know what you're asking, but I don't know how to get there at this very minute. I think you and I are thinking similarly, but I don't know if we know how to get there. Actually, to be honest with you, I'd like to hear from the Deputy Commissioner how they intend to frame this. I mean, this will be what they do. How do they intend to frame it? Maybe he doesn't want to come down and talk about that, but it'd be something. I know he's dying to come down here. He was just jumping up and down. But.
Welcome again, Mr. Meyer.
I knew you wanted to come down here, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, records for the Mr. Chairman, members, record Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. And I said, what do we do now? The deputy's not here, but I'll fill in for the question for you. The bill, and I do want to say thank you to Representative Dill for bringing this forward today. And we have been talking with people up there, and there is some concern up there, and Representative Dill, I apologize that you haven't heard that, but we'll be managing this park as a cohesive unit. It doesn't make sense, since they're contiguous, to manage it as two separate units. The issue of the name, we do have some concern about recognizing that location and its historic value is something I appreciate the discussion today on. And as the bill moves forward, maybe we could come up with some workable solution to do that. Maybe incorporating the two names or something like that might make sense. But our intention is to manage it as one unit initially and into the future. So,
Representative Borgenius.
Thank you. I understand wanting to manage it as one unit. That makes sense to me. But it does also make me want to think about if we're going to have a sign that says Vermilion State Park, that sign then says underneath it, Sudan Mine. That's the kind of thing I'm thinking about. And that we all have an agreement that something like that happens. But, I mean, if the community wants it, but I think we've got such a prize there that we don't want to give it away.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guinness, members, I agree. One of the fondest memories I have is going there as a child and exploring or taking that tour, seeing the canaries flying around, and that's something that I've remembered all of my life. So we need to preserve that history, and if the legislature so desires to combine the names, we'll make sure that the signage and the identity of the mine part of the state park is maintained as much as possible.
And Representative McNamara.
Well, mine is short, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dill. I know this has been hard for you, and it's not very often that we get Representative Wagenius, Representative Hackbart, yourself, and myself to all now be supporting such important legislation. So thank you, and we certainly do want to work with you. I know you have concerns, legitimate ones, about private property in that area and trying to keep a tax base other than just us folks coming up there to visit. So thank you for moving this forward. I appreciate that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, I'll help you come back to your roots here a little bit. My question is for Mr. Meyer. As everybody in the room knows, we're in a very difficult budget situation. The future looks worse than it did before today. What is the agency doing to, are we going to sell any parks or look at removing some liabilities that the state may have in order to offset or maybe offset and then some this particular purchase should it happen? I understand that, refresh me on how many state parks we have. I think there's one that they all lose money except one. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, actually, there's several questions there. First of all, we're required right now, we're working on a 25-year long-range strategic plan that was part of the dedicated funding bill that was passed. That one of the things that we're required or asked to look at is the decommissioning of existing parks, if that's needed or not. So we're in the process of working through that question. It's due, I believe, next February, so that will be part of the discussion for then. The state park system that we have last year was very successful. We had record attendance at all of our state parks. Camping was up, day use was up. So there was, not every park makes money, but overall it was a good year for attendance-wise and things like that. The purpose of the state park is not to make money, but to provide experience, protect an area so people can experience it for what it is, and that's exactly what this will do here. On the land sale piece of it, we'll be hearing the land bill, I believe, in Representative Deal's committee on March 15th, where we have a number of parcels to set for sale to continue to pay off the debt that was incurred two bienniums ago. I believe there was about $2 million still left on the books for us to dispose of to meet that goal. But also, we're looking at selling land to manage the land asset that we have. Sell the small parcels that are encroached upon by development that we no longer can use for its intended purpose. Consolidate what we have wherever we can, and actually manage the land as an asset. We need to create large parcels and divest of small parcels, and we're taking a look at that on a daily basis, trying to figure out, not specifically in parks. Parks represent 1% of the state land mass that the department administers currently. So not so much in state parks, but within the rest of our holdings, trying to manage that asset is a very important thing that we're taking a very active role in, and is very important to the department to make sure that we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. But what I'm wondering is, what are we doing as a state? What is the agency doing to consider its overall liabilities? I mean, we continue to be building things, and we're not in a position as a state in our future to be building more things and not removing associated liabilities somewhere else in order to continue to allow us to live within our means. We can't continue to add state parks and the associated staff and other costs and not offset it elsewhere without exacerbating the budget future that we're looking at right now. So what is the agency doing? And you talked a little bit about maybe looking at potential decommissions, but what is the agency doing to look at its overall portfolio and keeping it within a certain size so that it doesn't continue to inflate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, I need a little clarification from you. Are we talking about within the state park system? Are we talking about within our outdoor recreation system? There's a lot of different things we're doing in each one of those units of the Outdoor Rec Act. If it's specifically about the state park system, the answer is different compared to the wildlife management area, the scientific and natural area components.
Mr. Chair,
I'm Jaskowski.
Mr. Meyer, right now we're talking about the state park specifically, but certainly that type of analysis I would hope is happening in all the areas, but I'm curious about the state park system particularly.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kowski, within the state park system, we're trying to manage as efficiently as possible, looking at the facility costs that we have, where facilities are, making sure that they're run as efficiently and designed as efficiently as possible. We're working on a new facility right now at the Big Bog State Rec area that the legislature appropriated us to do. We're working on a new visitor center up in Grand Portage. The legislature appropriated money for us to do. Those weren't on our long-range plans. But it's the yin and the yang of where we're at with the park system. You folks are here. Your job is to represent the wants of your constituents. And members had constituents who wanted those facilities, and the legislature appropriated money to do so. We're looking at how we manage our state parks as effectively as possible to provide the opportunity that's out there. It's working together. So we're trying to figure that out right now. It's not an easy answer, because the system that we want and the system that we have sometimes are two different things. But we're hopeful that this system will be in the future self-sustaining. The opportunity that's there, the visitorship that we're projecting to be there, will provide, if it all comes to fruition, the operating revenue that we'll need plus to operate this system. It'll be what we hope it will turn into is an Itasca State Park opportunity on the water.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. Thank you. Well, Mr. Meyer, you know, I think we're all hoping that these things will turn a profit. Unfortunately, that's not what history tells us, and it's unlikely that will happen. I'm curious to how the agency looks at the overall fiscal impact of its work plan in the area of parks. Is there an interface between, or is there any fiscal analysis of the activity that state government has around parks, and does that at all have any bearing upon decisions that are made by the agency within the management and future long-range plans of the parks?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kowalski, certainly it does. I mean, in the past years, we've gone to satellite operations where we have parks that are close to each other. We're consolidating management out of one park rather than having park managers at both locations. We're looking at shoulder seasons, closing down. We've closed down parks for camping after September 1st and not opening it up until Memorial Day in a lot of the parks that we have that have lower usership that's there. We're looking at consolidating the management of our forest campgrounds and our state parks out of one unit as well. So those operational efficiencies we're achieving on a daily basis. We're managing it as we need to as a business and looking for those top cost savings wherever possible. So there are a lot of things that we're doing on that front. I can provide you more information if you're interested. But it's maintaining the system we have and being able to provide the access that people want is what we're trying to do. Balancing our wants and our needs on the operational side, but also on the deferred maintenance and development side as well.
And just want to remind members, we do still have, after this division report from Game, Fish, and Forestry, so we have three more questions on the list, and I'd like to move on then to the division report. So next, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to offer the suggestion, maybe I'm seeing this in a more simple manner than it actually is, but why not look at titling it Lake Vermilion and Sudan Underground Mine State Park? I mean, if we want to preserve the name, couldn't you call it both?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, members, that would work if that's what people would like to do.
And Representative Junkie.
What was the date of the DNR appraisal, and what was the dollar amount?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, the dollar amount is private data at this point in time. We've done several appraisals. I can get you the dates on which those appraisals have taken place.
So you're asking us to put something in statute on what we're going to pay for? You're not going to tell us what the appraisal is? Is that what you just told me?
Mr. Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Junkie, in state statute, the Data Privacy Act has a provision that does not allow, it's actually in the Landowner Bill of Rights, and it does not allow the state to disclose the value of the appraisal until the acquisition has taken place. The way that we've arrived at the $18 million was, Representative Junkie, you know how appraisals go very well. Being an appraiser yourself, the landowner had, the United States Steel had their land appraised, looking at it from their point of view. We came in and had an appraisal done. We, I believe, did another appraisal or re-examined that appraisal, and neither have been certified. We could not come to an agreement with the company about the price. The governor contacted United States Steel and made an offer of $18 million. United States Steel agreed to that with a donation of $2.3 million at the federal level, working through the IRS, and that's the price that we have. And it's as simple as that. Once the transaction occurs, all of the appraisal information will become public.
So, Mr. Chair, you've done two appraisals, DNR?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, I need to just confirm the exact appraisal situation. I can get back to you on that tomorrow.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Junkie.
Mr. Meyer, have we ever lifted our cap before on any of your parcels ever purchased since we've had a cap on appraisal? We buy an awful lot of land. We buy farmland. MnDOT is involved with takings all the time, and there's a reason the caps are there. Have we ever lifted that cap like this?
Mr. Meyer.
To your knowledge?
Chair, Representative Junkie, there's provisions that provide us the ability to pay over 10% of the appraised value. I need to go back and just historically check the records to make sure that I answer that question accurately.
Well, and Mr. Chair, this policy committee, you're setting a very dangerous precedent here. I can tell you, because I do right-of-way takings for MnDOT and counties, that, boy, if anyone gets a sense that we're able to lift and go above those limits as we do right-of-way acquisitions, and that's no different than this, we got a world of problems coming down the road on what we're going to pay for lands and other things. And I find it troubling we can't even figure out. I suppose I can take $18 million, what is it, 12%, subtract 12%. I guess I'd be close if that's where you're setting the cap. So, number one, I think it's a very dangerous precedent, which is one reason not to support this bill. But number two, Representative Dill and anyone else or council, we're direct. Why isn't this sitting over in bonding committee? Because we're directing right now $18 million. It says, you know, unless you got cash in your hand to pay for this, you're directing bonding dollars to be used, which I, in my mind, takes a two-thirds vote if we're directing bonding activity here. So I'm not even sure why it's here in a standalone bill. And why isn't this being done as a rider? Well, I think the bonding conference committee met today. Why are we not doing it there? What's going on here? And why are we running a separate bill? If you want it done, I think it's got to be in bonding. I suggest this takes a two-thirds vote as it moves along, too. You don't have a pot of cash, I don't think you're paying, are you?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
This language is in the bonding bill, in House File 2700.
So this is a de facto bonding bill, Representative Dill. I'm just trying to advise a little bit here. This is a two-thirds vote, in my mind. You're not expending any cash here. You're directing how bonding proceeds will be spent, and they haven't been approved for this expenditure yet. So when you're approving bonding expenditures, I'm pretty certain it's going to take a two-thirds vote as this moves along. So,
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Dill.
Well, the $20 million has already been approved,
right,
in the previous bonding bill. The only thing that we're changing here is the cap. The cap.
I know what you're doing, but I'm just suggesting you better check very closely with this before it moves along, because I think it's a bonding bill myself. So, and again, I can't believe we're lifting caps on this. This, we buy land all the time, and you're right, I am an appraiser, and you're right, I'm a DNR approved appraiser. And if you're going to lift limits on these caps, I mean, don't worry, the farmers in western Minnesota will understand that too, as all the 3/8 is coming through now. We're buying land. I think there's $7 million worth of land that we're going to be authorized to buy with the LCCMR bill. I mean, we're buying land all over here. Representative Drazkowski, you're right. So I assume you're not for this either, because you're not for buying any more land. Everyone who's now got a piece of land that they think has a value, and they'll all go out and get appraisals that are higher than what the DNR is doing, trust me. And now they'll be coming and asking every one of you to lift those caps, because, boy, my land's worth just a little bit more. It's really important that we sell it, really important we make that connection, really important we interfill that state park. This is a real important piece. And I think we're setting a very dangerous precedent, whether you want the park or not. If you want the park, you should pay the appraised price, plain and simple. That's why I asked what the dates were, too, because so we can get an understanding when they were done, when U.S. Steel's appraisals were done, how they compare with what the land markets have done over the last year, year and a half. I mean, there's a lot of analysis that isn't in front of me right now either on this. So, again, members, I would suggest this is not good at this time.
And Representative Junkie, I think you raise an important question about whether or not it would require a two-thirds vote if it is related to the bonding measure. And I'm not sure why it wouldn't have gone in with the bonding bill. But Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, going back to 2008, the Vermilion State Park came about in about three different bills, actually. There was a bill that appropriated $20 million for the acquisition of Lake Vermilion State Park, straight up in the bonding bill 2 that came out towards the end of session. Then there was session law that passed that had the proscriptive language that said the DNR can pay no more than 12% above the appraised value. Now, it didn't say what appraised value, it said the appraised value. So when we evaluated how to do this and what needed to be done to get the acquisition to occur, basically session law, you could have just had session law that would trump session law, and that's actually what we're doing here. So, and then there was a piece that passed in actually the Game and Fish Bill of Representative Dill's that had some other language in it as well. So it was in three different places that it passed, but the original bond appropriation just said $20 million for the acquisition and development, actually, it says, for Lake Vermilion State Park. We evaluated it as we prepared our legislative proposals for this session, and it was determined that session law was all need to be done, since session law in 2010 would trump the 2008 session law to deal with that prescriptive language.
So you're saying there's a precedent then that doesn't require a two-thirds, even though it affects the bonding measure. It can be done through statute.
Well, I don't like Mr. Chair. I don't think he's willing to
Mr. Chair,
certify
that
at all. That's his position. Mr. Chair.
Representative Junkin.
Again, you're not bond counsel or anything else. I mean, you're directing how bonding monies are to be spent. I mean, yeah, $20 million was directing, too, and everything else we did. But, you know, again, I'm confused why you're not sitting doing this in bonding committee right now. Why are we doing this, Representative Dill? I'm just trying to help you out here. I don't think you should be even wasting your time on this. The bonding committee's meeting. Governor's in the negotiations. This is his deal. Why are we even doing it here? What's going on with this today, and why are we trying to move it somehow? Is it not going to be part of the bonding bill? Is that falling apart? Is the governor not standing up for his position there?
Representative Dill?
I don't have the answers to all those questions. I'm not involved in the bonding negotiations that are going on, but I'm thinking through. I'm trying to think through the logic behind this. When we send out of Environment Finance a bill that says the following trails will be money recommended for this trail, that trail, the other trails, other projects, rim, crap, and all those things, those are recommendations for how to spend bonding money. And eventually, when that gets into the bonding bill, we get the two-thirds vote, and then it's done.
Right.
But we don't need a two-thirds vote in committee to send those out of Representative Wagenius's committee. We only need a simple majority.
Mr. Chair, I didn't
say. I'm not bond counsel here, and I'm certainly not, and I'm not that knowledgeable, but I'd like to hear from them, in fact, if what you're saying is accurate. But as far as today is concerned, I believe there's only needs to be a simple majority vote to pass this bill out of the committee.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Johnson.
I'm not suggesting you need a vote in committee, Representative Dill, or any committee. You need a two-thirds vote on the floor, which is my question. If you're running this bill as a standalone and get it to the floor and get a pass on it, this is a bonding bill. So I'm just suggesting it's going to take a two-thirds vote on the floor. So I don't know why you're even doing it. Because you won't get a two-thirds vote on the floor, I predict. And why isn't it being done in the bonding bill right now? I'm trying to save you some valuable time. I know how valuable your time is. So, I don't know why you're doing this. Why isn't it being done as an amendment over in the bonding bill committee right now? Because it will take a two-thirds vote, I suggest, once it hits the floor. Not here. Not in committee.
Well, and I think that's something that we need to look into. And we do have other questions here. Representative Stirner?
I was just wondering, I mean, is it possible we can call the question on it, or is it that's not a normal protocol? Otherwise, I'd like to at least do a roll call on the vote.
Okay. Roll call has been requested. I think we'll give an opportunity just for the last question. And Representative Dill.
Did you have another question?
There is still one more question. Representative Anderson has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just quick, and to clarify a point brought up by Representative Junkie, are we talking about spending 2008 bonding money that's already put aside, or is this new 2010 money that has to be appropriated by the bonding committee? What are we talking about here?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's 2008 money. The DNR was appropriated in the 2008 bonding bill, $20 million for acquisition and development. So this appropriation and the acquisition will leave us $2 million to begin initial development of this site as well.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
So then why is there a request again in 2010 for bonding money for this same project?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative, there was session law that passed after the bonding bill passed that put a cap on the amount of money that we could actually pay for the acquisition, that said the DNR may pay no more than 12% above appraised value. So what we're doing is allowing us to pay more than 12%. We're paying the price that has been negotiated is $18 million. So we're allowing us to purchase the park for $18 million. And if you take that price and we're getting 5 miles of shoreline So if you take 5 miles, 25,000 feet divided by $18 million, and look at the current value of a foot of shoreline on Lake Vermilion, we think it's a pretty good deal.
And Mr. Meyer, we're checking into it, but I was informed that that the cap was in the 2008 bonding bill. Mm-hmm. So, and we do have just one more question, then we're moving on, and I know Ms. Erickson would like to just say a few words as well. So, Representative Falk, very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was just to follow up with Mr. Meyer about the bond letting process. This has been appropriated, but these bonds haven't been let, so how long will they sit on the books, or I mean, how long is this process going to be into play?
Okay, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, it's our anticipation is to close on this deal. The deal that we have actually with United States Steel says till May 31st. So it's our intention to have this bill or this allowance to purchase the land for $18 million done before and have the closing take place before May 31st. Bond appropriations are available for, I believe, 5 years, and they cancel after the sixth year. So we still have 4 years left on the bond appropriation.
Okay. And Ms. Judy Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I'm with the Parks and Trails Council, and I'll be very brief tonight. I'm also speaking for the Minnesota Environmental MEP Partnership. And just very briefly, in 2008, Parks and Trails Council and MEP supported the establishment of Lake Vermilion State Park. The legislation that you have today, and thank you for Representative Dill for bringing this forward, takes us one step closer. And so our position is that we support the language changes that are needed in this bill to move this acquisition forward. And we just wanted to make sure that you also knew that there were a lot of citizens who care very much about this issue and are supporting moving forward with a new state park. I will say Minnesota has always led the nation in state parks. We've had a wonderful legacy. Itasca State Park passed by one vote of the legislature, and I think we're all really grateful that they did that back in 1891. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. And Representative Johnson.
Just to follow up, Representative Dill, if this bill moves along as a standalone, like for some reason you're trying to do instead of doing it in the bonding bill, my suggestion would be, whether I support it or not, is to not direct the dollar amount. I think the problem with your bill is it directs $18 million in bonding proceeds and how to be used. If you want to adjust the cap, you should do that by a percent. And then you're not actually directing bonding dollars. You're just putting in place a policy that on this park you can go an X percent above appraised value. That's a strict policy thing, and then it could fall anywhere from the appraised value up to that percent. And so I think you're cleaner that way and probably avoid any questions on bonding. If you insist on moving this ahead alone, I'd take the $18 million out and say appraised value plus 15% or 12% or 20% or whatever it is. Would make it a lot cleaner and probably avoid that question in the future if your intent is to move this out on the House floor for a vote.
And I still think we do, Representative Dill, go ahead.
Well, I want the bill to go forward as it is today, and we'll seek some counsel on how that should look and see if, you know, I take under advisement what Representative Jucky has brought. He's very knowledgeable in these things. We'll take it under advisement, and we'll get some answers to some of these questions. And so I'd ask that we go ahead with the bill at this point. We can maybe make some mid-course corrections once we've received counsel on this issue. And one last thing I wanted to just mention very briefly, but to acknowledge the fact that the company that owns this land is a major corporation in the world, and a major corporation in northern Minnesota and in our community. And for those who want the park, they should be very thankful that this land has not been developed and that they have kept the land in the type of condition that it is in for nearly 100 years. So with that, I'd like to thank the company for their work as well.
And I do think we need to look into the matter further after we take the vote here in committee. Obviously, we don't need the two-thirds vote here, but I think we need to ask the question for later. And we did confirm that the cap increase was established in the 2008 bonding bill. Right. So there is a precedent set there. With that, anything else before we move on? Again, we have the division report to do. So, seeing none, Representative Dill, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew the motion. Is there a roll call on that?
There is a roll call.
Is this going to finance?
This is going to finance. Yes. Representative Dill renews his motion that House File 2838 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And roll call has been requested, so the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Bigham? Representative Cornish? Representative Dill?
Yep.
Representative Druskowski?
No.
Representative Eakin?
Yes.
Representative Falk?
Pass.
Representative Gardner? Representative Hackbarth? Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Junkie?
No.
Representative Loon? Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Representative Purcell? Representative Saylor?
Yes.
Representative Sterner?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen? Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
Falk changes to yes.
Falk changes to yes. There being eight ayes and three nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. And now to the division report. Representative Dill, do you want to move the adoption of the Game Fish and Forestry Division report for House File 2954?
I'd like to make that motion.
Okay. Representative Dill moves the adoption of the Game Fish Forestry Division reports of House File 2954. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. And we have now adopted the game, the report. It is now before us. And Representative Dill, there's an amendment here as well. That's right. Okay. Representative Dill, would you like to move House File 2954?
I would.
Representative Dill moves that House File 2954, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. Representative Dill, to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Mr. Tomlinson come down. He can rattle through this more quickly than I can. It would be just easier and more time efficient to have him run through the provisions of the bill.
Again, welcome, Mr. Tomlinson. And just to remind members, this is a division report. It's already been thoroughly vetted in Representative Dill's committee with testimony and testifiers. Mr. Tomlinson, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Bob Tomlinson, DNR Division of Forestry Assistant Director. The overview of the bill. This is basically the omnibus forestry bill for the year, with a couple of additions that Representative Dill has put in there as well. But sections 1 and 2 of the bill basically deal with burning. One is dealing with the general burning permits, allowing for establishment of an alternative to the requirement for written burning permits in southwestern Minnesota, predominantly agricultural counties. Section 2 is the permanent tree open burning sites, that's provisions for site dimensions, burn pile site operating conditions, and smoke management on permanent tree and brush open burning sites. Section 3 of the bill deals with the service fees charged to landowners. Just basically that once we charge fees, that we, in the essence of transparency, that they be published by written order in the state register. Section 4 of the bill deals with the forest management lease provision, which increases the forest management lease from 3,000 acres to 20,000 acres, our opportunities to do that. And then Section 5 of the bill deals with reoffering unsold timber. This would allow us to go back into and reoffer sales that have unsold due to poor market conditions or because of decadence in the stand and the likelihood that those sales wouldn't be. there's an interest to for forest health purposes to have those sites perhaps regenerated and reestablished as healthy, productive forest land. And it would be in our interest, we feel, to offer those at a lower price than what was originally appraised, but for forest management, forest health purposes. And I emphasize that wouldn't be done across the board, but only for those stands that we feel are in dire need of regeneration stand. And then Section 6 of the bill deals with intermediate auction sales. This would allow, this is one of Representative Dill's provisions that allows the number of permits the number of employees that a permit holder can have to be moved from 20 to 30, and also then specifies in there that when the Division of Forestry has a question relative to whether a permit holder is a big operator or a small operator, that that'll be determined by worker comp records through the Department of Labor and Industry, which we are very supportive of. Section 7 of the bill is the auction sale procedures. Basically, it makes sure, more date certain, if you will, that in the case of sealed bid auctions, that the bid guarantee must be received within 14 days of the sealed bid opening. Right currently, it's within 10 days, I believe, of the notice of sale, and there's some uncertainty around that. And then the second part of the Section 7 of the bill deals with the bid guarantee, and basically what we are saying here is that just they have the bid guarantee only apply when the bid is bid up more than $5,000 over the appraised price. And then section, and we feel that both of these will help clarify and expedite the timber sale permitting process for us and the consumer as well. And then Section 8 of the bill is a repealer that we feel that with, because of the fact that we now have the DNR's forest information system on timber sales in place, that we can readily provide any information regarding numbers of permits, number of sales, numbers of acres, numbers of cords, and all that sort of thing, on real-time information anytime during the year to anybody who asks for it. And besides, we just didn't feel that the report that we were submitting was being looked at. There was much better information elsewhere, so we wanted to repeal that need for that annual report. And that in essence, is the bill that we have before you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Looking at the general burning permit, and you talk about conditions, but there is no requirement that the sheriff be notified, which has been a common condition of a burning permit. That seems troubling to me, but not you, huh?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Representative Wagenius, I'm not sure if it'd be the sheriff or the somebody else, but somebody would be notified of the what we're basically proposing here is that in those counties where we no longer have a forestry presence and where there aren't very many township fire wardens, keep in mind that currently you have a paper permit system via fire wardens that are, you know, agents, I think, of the DNR is what you call those. And then you have the electronic burn permit system that's readily available in most places in the state. Now what we're saying is that we'd like to offer a third opportunity, which would be this blanket program in those counties that choose to do so, and that we would work with them to come up with a good program in each county, recognizing it might be different in one county than another. But certainly, Representative McGinnis, one of the things we would probably want to do is make sure that somebody is notified within the county of when the burn is going to occur. And that would be one of the things that we would consult with the county on and who that ought to be.
Representative McGinnis.
But in the language, there is no notification provision. And it seems to me, and it may not be the sheriff, but it seems to me that somebody does need to be notified, because I've gotten burn permits both written and electronically, and some of the fires have been really big, and somebody is going to call the sheriff and want to know what's going on. So we have to have that kind of back and forth with a sheriff or somebody, whoever it's going to be. Even, and this is in an agricultural area, but you can have big fires.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Well, I appreciate you pointing that out, Representative Guinness, and perhaps we could work to look where we can include something like that in this language as we're kind of moving the bill forward. I'm not prepared right now to say where it might go or whatever, but certainly we could take a look at that. I appreciate that that advice.
Any other questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Representative Dillon, on page 5, the language, I actually am wondering, and I did have a quick conversation with Mr. Tomlinson. I actually am thinking on line 5.23. Did you say it's going to Commerce next, Mr. Chair?
It's going to state and local government.
State and local government. I actually am wondering, Mr. Tomlinson, if instead of workers' compensation on line 5.23, I actually think what you wanted to put in there is unemployment insurance. The Commissioner of Labor and Industry does have records that would allow you to determine the number of employees under unemployment insurance, but the work comp is actually private between the insurance carrier and the company. I don't know if you're going to get access. I'm not exactly sure where this language came from, if it was from Representative Dill. I'm wondering if maybe if somebody talked to the Department of Labor and Industry, it may have been wrong. It's not a big deal, but I would just recommend you find out which agency it's supposed to be, because I think what you're trying to do is allow the DNR commissioner, if I don't think you if qualify, Representative Dill, and I question it currently, some privacy laws might not allow Commissioner Holston to get the records, and that's what we're trying to do here. I guess my point would be I think that might mean to say unemployment instead of work comp. I'm not moving an amendment, but I just bring it to your attention. And getting it here on the record, I think, will help if they question why did it move out of committee, unless Mr. Tomlinson has some feelings.
Mr. Tomlinson?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I think that's good advice, and we're willing to do things to make to improve the bill. Of course, I've talked to you about what the intent here is that we just want to have a standard, consistent process for making that determination between who are big operators and who are smaller operators. And so what you're suggesting is that it may or may not be the Department of Labor and Industry, but that perhaps the unemployment records payment, unemployment insurance numbers might be a better one than the workers' comp records is what I'm hearing you say. And that's something we could talk with Department of Labor and Industry, I think, about between now and the next stop where this has to go again. So,
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's probably more appropriate in the other committees that Representative Dill will be going before than this committee anyway. But I don't think that one works for you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Dill, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, sir.
And Representative Dill renews the motion that House File 2954, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed, and the meeting is adjourned.